On this week's program, David Patrick Stearns profiles Philadelphia-based composer Morris Wright. We drop in on rehearsals for Unplug, a theatrical interactive live sound and song journey through Philadelphia by Lyric Fest. Susan Lewis visits Friend or Foe, an exhibition at the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Philadelphia, exploring the value of copies and forgeries. And we listen back to an interview with Terry Halbert. After spending 5 years creating Temple's hugely successful general education program, she steps down as its director at the end of this month. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
For many in the Delaware Valley, Lenape is a name in the phone book, a large high school in suburban New Jersey, a pizza place in Westchester, maybe even a football team. However, the Lenape Indians, who once inhabited the Wissahickon Valley, have been the topic of earnest discussion, along with other banished Native American tribes, in an American Philosophical Society conference this week titled Native American Voices. But what set this conference apart from others was a concurrent musical premiere. One of Philadelphia's most durable composers, Morris Wright, built a violin concerto around Lenape melodies in a world premiere titled Wissahickon Scenes, by the Philadelphia Classical Symphony, heard at Delaware Community College on Tuesday and in Center City last night. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reports on how this unlikely cultural fusion was achieved and on similar endeavors that are in the air.
Composer Morris Wright was already quite sympathetic to the Native American culture when he was invited to write a piece for the Philadelphia Classical Symphony that somehow dialogues with the Lenape Indians. In the many creative travels of this near 30-year member of Temple University's composition faculty, Wright had even read the infamous State of the Union Address by President Andrew Jackson, proposing the 1830 Indian Removal Act as charitable treatment for a nation whose land had been stolen by white America. What Wright hadn't heard was Lenape voices. He had thought about doing some high-tech multimedia piece when Philadelphia Classical Symphony director Carl Middleman told him about Native American field recordings made in 1928 on a primitive dictaphone and housed at the American Philosophical Society. Hearing them was captivating in a way that circumvented the usual reactions of like and dislike. In fact, Wright decided to include one of the recordings in his final movement.
It sounds very fragile, like it's barely there, like it may fade away. And so it was the fragileness of the document that struck me. And I like the sound of the chief's voice. And so it's a sense, I think, of this very beautiful document that was right on the edge of disappearing into the noise. And we played at rehearsal, and everyone it stops and thinks a little bit differently about the music after you hear these voices, or this voice from the past.
In post-performance conversations, violin soloist Hirono Oko corroborated that experience.
There's something more, the soul behind the music or something. Also, then I went back to my music and looked at, that's actually a prayer. So I say, ooh, I missed that part. Because you feel that from that. You know, it's a very simple melody. It's a very simple melody, but you feel so much from that. It's amazing.
Morris Wright chose about 5 Lenape melodies that he transcribed from the dictaphone recordings and often needed high-tech tools to slow and stretch these ancient songs so as not to miss a nuance. Several were incorporated into his 3-movement concerto, which begins with pleasure dances, and then in the second movement depicts the Trail of Tears as Indians trudged west, expelled from their land.
As you can imagine, I struggled with, what am I going to bring to this?
In Indian melodies are no stranger to classical music. Dvorak's New World Symphony has them, with many of the quirks ironed out so as to better suit the grand scheme of the piece. You could listen to it for years and not feel that there's anything Native American in there. More recently, the Native American plight has been confronted with a head-on frontal attack of emo rock in the show Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, which has turned into a surprise hit currently at New York's Off-Broadway Public Theater. That musical goes so far as to present Andrew Jackson, the guy on the $20 bill, as a genocidal maniac in hard-hitting songs by Philadelphia-born composer Michael Friedman.
So I'll sing the saddest songs of enemies who did me wrong, and the war will go on and on and on and on and on and on as long as we need.
It's a provocative message to be reaching an impressionable young audience. Morris Wright, however, refrained from any finger-pointing, working instead to unite two fundamentally different civilizations. Anything from Europe is inevitably based on the classicism of Greek antiquity. Those concepts of symmetry and proportion are usually behind most any creative act. The Indian nation had none of this. As a result, the music has an uncontained quality with constantly shifting meters and frequently repeating notes. As mercurial as it seems, the music wasn't improvisatory or accidental, Wright believes, but functioned mainly to intone words. That meant Wright sometimes had to decide what's an inflection and what's a change of pitch. Bringing together the two aesthetics without diluting either side would seem impossible, yet Wright seems to have done it.
Here is the prayer song called Ati Hamlin Song, and I'll just play the tune for you. If you take just the notes of that tune, and line them up, there's kind of a nice fuzzy chord. Imagine you have a photograph and then you blur it so you get kind of a sum total of all the colors. I like to do that with pitches. And maybe mine that then to find chords that will come up. I wondered what would happen if I delayed the tune by a beat, since the repetitions of the piece delay it by a beat, and then played it a fourth lower. Here's the tune lower. Put them together and you get.
How much does it really matter? Regardless of what the music says to the naked ear, the concerto represents a metaphysical resolution that no treaty, no financial compensation for once stolen land, can accomplish. At a time when American society is increasingly fractured, politically and morally, perhaps more than any time since the 1960s, any act of selfless conciliation between societies with a history of alienation, no matter how big or small, goes out into the world like a prayer.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Unplug, the latest family concert presentation from LyricFest, the Philadelphia Vocal Ensemble, takes audiences on a musical trip through the city in the company of an 8-year-old boy and an eccentric tour guide. The theatrical, interactive live sound and song journey features jazz, opera, Broadway, classical song, dance and more. The narrative for the show was created by Jake Miller, who also plays the role of the guide in the show. I spoke with him at rehearsals earlier this week and first asked him how he was approached to write Unplug.
Artistic directors came with this idea that they would present a concert that would be about a kid. That's all we kind of knew, was about a kid who was always plugged into his technology, his iPod or his cell phone and that sort of thing. And so then once that germ happened, we just kind of went for it because it seemed like a natural evolution of what LyricFest was already doing, which was is very much about bringing the sounds of classical music and the sounds of opera to a wider community, and especially in their family concert, to a younger community that may not otherwise be exposed to these kinds of sounds.
It's a musical journey around Philadelphia.
It is. It's about the kid, Danny, who is always plugged in, and his dad feels the need to unplug him and send him on his way to become a little cultured. And he encounters a ridiculous tour guide who then sets off with him to kind of learn the city together. And they discover the sounds of Philadelphia as sort of an unlikely pair, the two of them.
How did the music suggest itself? Because there's a huge variety of different types of songs, different genres.
Yeah, where I step into the process is that the directors, Suzanne and Randy and Laura, come already with a set of music that they're kind of looking at. And I'm not sure if it comes out of the repertoire that...
But they gave you a list of songs that says, hey, write a story around this.
Yes, they came with a germ of an idea about this kid that needs to unplug and a bunch of songs, and they said it has something to do with being around Philadelphia, and off we went.
is this like an opera plot, or does it have to make sense?
This one has to make sense because it's about placing all of this music from a wide range within a context that an 8-year-old can understand. So the idea is not just to have an art song recital is one thing for adults, an art song recital for an 8-year-old is a different thing altogether. And so it has to be a plot that is exciting enough and has to put all of these songs from all over the globe, all of these different styles of music, within a context, that within that narrative. And so we find ourselves in Valley Forge, but then we find ourselves singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, you know.
Well, we don't need to guess where that takes place.
We don't know, yeah, exactly. So yeah, it becomes a journey through all of this different music, but for the 8-year-old that's sitting in the audience, it's a journey around a city that they probably have a little bit of knowledge of, so it becomes a little more accessible.
And to what extent did the song titles dictate the narrative?
Completely.
So how did something like Accentuate the Positive, where is that in the show?
Sure. Well, we knew that song was happening, and it's not tied to a specific geography like many of the songs are, and it's a lesson song. And so we used it now as the closer to the first act, where this zany tour guide and the kid have their first moment of learning together, where they've kind of gotten themselves worked up. And so they learn this lesson to, you know, look on the bright side, which spins them off into a different kind of adventure in the second act.
Pandemonium, liable to land upon the sea.
ensemble performance of Accentuate the Positive, the Johnny Mercer Harold Arlen song, is featured in the latest Lyric Fest production, Unplug. Performances are this afternoon at 3 at the Presbyterian Church of Chestnut Hill, and tomorrow afternoon at 3 at the First Presbyterian Church of Philadelphia at 21st and Walnut Streets. The Rosenbach Museum and Library in Center City, Philadelphia is a repository for original documents and artifacts. James Joyce's manuscript for Ulysses, Bram Stoker's Notes for Dracula, original illustrations for Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, to name but a few. Yet there are also objects that, due to accident, innocence, or even deliberate deceit, are not quite what they seem. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores an exhibition that considers how and why items are copied or altered over time, and why it matters or doesn't.
It's often been sort of a dirty little secret that museums contain all kinds of things that aren't perfect.
Judy Gustin, curator and director of collections at the Rosenbach Museum and Library, says people are conditioned to think that things must be perfect and pristine to have value.
And we wanted to sort of dispel that myth in a way. There are all kinds of things in collections that have these other stories to them.
The other stories of how and why documents, objects, and paintings have been copied or altered is the subject of the show Friend or Faux, F-A-U-X, Imitation and Invention from Innocent to the Fraudulent. It explores legitimate copies and forgeries, issues of authentication and attribution, and why local legends spring up about things that never were. There's a portrait by 19th century artist Thomas Scully and a copy made by someone else.
The person in the original was already dead. The son of the sitter was visiting Philadelphia, wanted a copy of this portrait of his father because he was moving far away. He was moving to Kentucky. And the father's painter was not available.
So the artist's daughter, who had honed her skills copying her father's work, painted another copy of the portrait.
And so the question is, if these two paintings were apart, could you tell the difference between them? And would that matter?
In some cases, an object or document was altered to make something whole. An original edition of The Pilgrim's Progress turns out to be patched together from several separate books. Rosenbach librarian Elizabeth Fuller says the popular book had been just about read to pieces, literally. Because complete first editions were then impossible to find, people like the museum's co-founder, a rare book collector, would just create one.
In 1921, Dr. Rosenbach bought three copies, each of which was missing a number of pages. The copy we have here, every page is a page from a first edition of Pilgrim's Progress, just not all from the same copy to begin with.
Standards of acceptable restoration were different then. Curatorial assistant Kathy Haas points to two portrait miniatures which were spruced up by repainting.
Nowadays, if you take something to a conservator, they tend to be very minimalist about what kinds of additions and changes they will make in an attempt to conserve the work. And in fact, a conservator who looked at one of these two miniatures actually noted that it would be very easy to confuse this miniature of the Bishop of Winchester with a forgery because so little of the original paint surface is at all visible or survives.
Then there are also copies actually created to deceive. Dr. Rosenbach was a fan of Shakespeare and Shakespeare forgeries like those by a young, late 18th century Englishman. This real-life tale of ambition and deceit is read to visitors by Jack Lynch, Associate Professor of English at Rutgers University.
William Henry Ireland began discovering Shakespeare manuscripts in 1794 while he was still a teenager, and at first the critical world believed they were genuine.
The story is that after Ireland found an undiscovered Shakespearean play and tried to stage it, he was eventually found out. But it also made him something of a celebrity.
And he knew his original handwritten forgeries would be worth money as mementos of the famous dispute of the 1790s. So he pasted the original Shakespeare manuscripts into albums like this one, added prefaces and captions explaining when and how he forged them, and sold the lot to a book collector.
Ireland's forgeries themselves did become valuable enough to copy.
William Henry Ireland was selling forged Shakespeare and then even forgeries of his own forgeries.
In some other purchases, Dr. Rosenbach was fooled. Curatorial assistant Kathy Haas says he enjoyed a silver mug with the monogram GW on the front. On the bottom is a birthday inscription to George Washington.
He bought it from a British dealer, W.E. Hercom, for £15 in 1925. He believed it to be genuine.
But it turned out to be a fake. Today, technology has enabled more thorough checks of the origins of works where there are questions, from scientific analysis to internet communication with other museums and scholars all over the world. But regardless of historical facts, most objects have stories attached, and some local legends just won't go away. This show includes Nathaniel Hawthorne's personal copy of Moby Dick, but it's not inscribed by Herman Melville, as many believe. There's also a manuscript copy of one of the most famous legal documents in America.
The Declaration of Independence.
But not in the hand of you-know-who.
It was written in the 18th century, but ours was not written by Thomas Jefferson. Nonetheless, we always get a lot of inquiries about what about that Thomas Jefferson copy of the Declaration of Independence.
So what does drive our fascination with objects? Whose company they've kept? Whose hand made those smudges? Whose lips brushed that mug? The Rosenbach sometimes brings objects out of their cases on special house tours.
When someone finally realizes that they are touching something that one of our founding fathers wrote, it's thrilling. Those objects can really stir your emotions.
In a world where most of us live surrounded by copies of some sort, even if they're not scandalous forgeries or altered heirlooms, it's worth considering what we value, whether we're collectors or just museum visitors. Old objects, original documents, or copies of a holiday photograph. Maybe just something that connects us with someone we knew or wish we had.
WRTI Susan Lewis. Friend or Foe, Imitation and Invention, From Innocent to the Fraudulent, is at the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Philadelphia through July 11th. In addition to educating undergrads in their major areas of study, universities also require that their students complete courses in a wider variety of subjects. 5 years ago, Temple charged Terry Halbert, then a law professor, with giving this core curriculum a makeover to make the most of new technology and teaching methods, and to take advantage of Temple's location in a large city. In cooperation with faculty and students, Halbert set about designing and implementing new courses that would satisfy this mandate, and so far she's had some remarkable successes. General Education, or GenEd, has received praise from students and plaudits from educators around the country for its many innovations. GenEd's mission is about making connections between academic knowledge and current controversies, connections across different areas of study, and connections between the classroom and the dynamic city of Philadelphia. A side benefit of using the city as a classroom is that thousands of Temple undergrads are now showing up at arts, culture, and historic sites for coursework, and a cultural passport created by Terry Halbert in cooperation with these organizations is allowing students free or reduced admissions both for study and pleasure. Terry Halbert steps down as director of Temple's Gen Ed program later this month. I spoke to her late last year.
When we started this program, we wanted faculty to come up with new courses and to inspire them. We thought, let's tell them why we're doing this. So every course proposal had to meet some learning goals. And some of them were basic things like teaching critical thinking and communication skills, teaching students how to manage information. But then there were goals that were not required. They were just optional. And one of them was develop an understanding of Temple's urban setting. So it was just out there for faculty to choose to respond to if they wanted to. And what happened was about a year ago when we launched the program and I looked at the 100 or so courses that had been approved, I was surprised because about a third of them were designed in response to that goal and that were taking students out of the campus, off the campus, and into the city.
And this is covering all areas of study.
Right.
History, the arts, science.
Right. This is a multidisciplinary program. We have social science, hard science, and the arts in Gen Ed. And these experiences that were embedded run the gamut right across the curriculum. So we've got a course on creativity that demands that students go down to First Friday and interview an artist. We've got a science course called Sustainable Design that takes students to the new science center that was built by Germantown Friends School.
Something that the cultural community has become aware of is that there are thousands of undergrads here, many of whom are now, thanks to your endeavors, becoming new audience members, both for performance, for museums, for all kinds of cultural organizations. Tell us about how that evolved.
So we have 4,000 new Gen Ed students every year. We've been running the program. This is our second year. We have 8,000 students who have to take about one-third of their courses in our program. And I think what we're seeing is with the courses that take students out into the city, because the experiences they're having are integrated with the material they're learning, because they don't just go, but then they reflect on what happened when they went, we're learning that there's a lot of impact here. The experiences aren't just flyby. They're meaningful, they're deeper, they're richer. So, for example, we're starting to ask our students in these courses, we're calling it PECS, by the way, the Philadelphia Experience. So we're surveying the students in the PECS courses and asking them things like, well, we ask them at the start of the course questions about their attitudes towards the city, whether they go, how often they go, what kinds of things they do, how comfortable they feel. And I can tell you just from the first round of assessing some 800 undergrads last spring, we found that about half of them said they were more comfortable in the city after the course than they had been, and two-thirds of them said they'd be glad to take another PECS course and have another encounter. So I remember one particular comment from a student who had taken The Art of Listening, which takes students to opera and to the orchestra and to the art museum to hear jazz. Students said, before I took this class, you couldn't have dragged me to an opera with a tractor. But now I'm really happy to go, and I'm going to take my friends, and I'm going to make it part of my life.
And this is not an uncommon reaction.
No, I think this is happening across the board. Students are realizing that it's a very big deal to not be hearing music through the iPod, but to actually be in the room when the music is being made and performed. And part of this conscious effort, I think, on the part of a lot of our faculty is to help our students become educated consumers of art. So we have professors who are actually talking to students about the mechanics of getting there and feeling comfortable in the concert hall. Where do you want to sit? How do you clap? When do you clap? And what should you wear? And they're getting this in part because in one of our courses, one of the assignments is to actually strike up a conversation with someone you're sitting next to at the orchestra, ask them about their concert-going history and their own involvement, and find out what it means to be a patron.
Temple University's Director of General Education, Terry Halbert, who steps down from her position at the end of this month. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony and C under their music director, Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan, our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.